Davis Miller has made a career writing about the life of Muhammad Ali. His 1994 piece for Esquire, titled The Zen of Muhammad Ali, even earned him a Pulitzer Prize nomination. Miller recently joined us to tell us the personal story of his friendship with a former world heavyweight champ in his own words.
When I first saw Muhammad Ali, I was 11 years old. My mom had died a few months before, and I was almost catatonically depressed. It was January 1964, and I was sitting sadly in front of my father's little black and white television, turned it on, flipped channels, and suddenly there was this face and this voice in front of me who said,
"I'm young, I'm handsome, I'm fat, I'm pretty, and can't possibly be beat.
I'm young, I'm handsome, I'm fast and pretty, and can't possibly be beat." It felt like the glory train had passed through me. And I lived vicariously through Ali all through my teen years. Ali was my man. He was my alter ego. He was everything I wasn't. He was king of the world. And I was this skinny, scrawny, little, terribly depressed kid in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I was 4'10" and weighed 63 pounds when I was a junior in high school, and my high school nickname was Fetus. I imitated his voice terribly. I got really cocky with my mouth, which got me beaten up even more regularly than it would have otherwise. I learned to throw a jab like Ali. I could dance clockwise and counterclockwise like him. It gave me some sort of solace in my otherwise bleak life. But I met him first in 1975. He was then world heavyweight champion again. He was training to fight British champion Joe Bugner in a world title bout.
Round four. Ali in the white trunks, Bugner in the blue. Ali the black man, Bugner the white man. That's a more direct way to say it.
And by that time, I was fancying myself as a world champion kickboxer. And my friend Bobby Montequillo, who was Angelo Dundee's nephew, suggested that if I drive up to Ali's training camp in Deer Lake, Pennsylvania, he could get me in the ring with him. So I did it. I hopped in my old Camaro and drove those 600-plus miles. Ali at the time would have sparred with anyone from three-year-old tykes to their 97-year-old great-grandmamas. It was fun. I was trembling head to toe until the bell rang. And then he pointed at me and said, "I could be your daddy if I was white." And as soon as that happened, I relaxed. I had seen him and studied everything he'd done. So when he went back into his rope-a-dope and he sat there looking sleepy, I managed to catch the guy with a three-punch combination. The crowd oohed and aahed, and it woke Ali up. He hit me with a single jab, and I suddenly couldn't see, couldn't hear, didn't know where I was. Spectators sounded like they were a galaxy far, far away, and my legs went to soup. He draped his arm around me and said, "You're fast, and you sure can't hit to be so little." He led me, looking freshly electrocuted, from the ring, and it was one of the highlights of my life. Some many years later, Easter weekend 1988, drove past a house that I knew to be Ali's mother's home on Lambert Avenue. And there was this block-long ivory-colored Winnebago with license plates on it that read, "The Greatest." I drove past, probably drove a couple miles past the house, worked up my courage, turned around, went back, parked behind the Winnebago, went up and knocked on the door. Ali did not recognize me when he first leaned under the frame of the door. Now, he was deeply Parkinsonian by then, and so he didn't talk much. He gestured me in with his fingers, did magic tricks for me. He would pull a silk scarf from what seemed to be an empty hand. We got out in his mom's front yard and play boxed. It was on a corner lot, and cars stopped all around. People cranked down their windows, and people waved and cheered. Kids rode past on bicycles. "Hey, champ! Hey, champ!" Then after we mock boxed, he whispered in my ear, "Come on in the house." And he invited me in to dinner with his mom and his brother and himself. It was an out-of-body experience. I've never done hallucinogens, but it felt like I'd taken LSD. We talked about a half hour. Ali wasn't at all like the few thin stories that were being published about him during those days. He wasn't brain dead. He wasn't in some near vegetative state. He wasn't broken. In many respects, he was no less Ali than he had ever been, and may have been even made wise by his Parkinson's.
I'm going to give him a real whooping, and I wrote a poem. Some of you heard it.
The way Ali treated Joe Frazier is, in many respects, shameful, particularly before the third Ali Frazier fight, the Thriller in Manila.
He said there will be a killer and a thriller and a killer when I get the gorilla in Manila.
He had knocked out George Foreman in Zaire almost exactly 1 year before, in October 1974. And it went terribly to Ali's head. He'd always had that gargantuan, bordering on obscene ego, and it just got out of control. And he acted horribly. I've seen him weep when he's watched footage of himself calling Joe Frazier a gorilla. He apologized to Joe, to his face. Joe never forgave him. I think over the years, Ali outgrew all of that. He surely does not want anybody to feel sorry for him. I think he's become a greater man in his years with Parkinson's. I think it's actually served him well that he doesn't speak easily anymore. Because if he did, we'd still be hearing this sweetly insane narcissist who just couldn't keep his mouth shut, where instead he's become this whispering muse. And he's aware of every bit of that, and he considers the Parkinson's disease a sort of gift. He has offered to give me basically everything in his house at one time or another. He's offered a Muhammad Ali Athlete of the Century Award. And it's not because we're friends. He does that with almost anyone. He treats you as if you were a cousin or his long-lost brother. He'd invite you to have a meal with him, play with his kids or grandkids if they were there. He'd invite you to spend the night and just hang out until you wanted to leave. I've asked him why he's so very generous. The thing he said to me is that, "I've treated so many people so bad, I gotta make up for it." He says that the way he'd like to be remembered is as an enormously generous person. He's still reviled by some people, but hundreds of millions, if not billions of people, love him. No matter who Ali says he is and isn't, and no matter who you and I say he is and isn't, he falls outside of our concepts of who we believe him to be. And he takes pleasure in that. He notices that and likes to sort of pick up the carpet of the universe and give it a sweet, friendly shake and peer underneath and see what's there and be this little cosmic brat that says, "I don't have to be who you want me to be."
That's Davis Miller. His latest book is Approaching Ali, A Reclamation in Three Acts. Our segment was produced by Gary Wallach. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. Our technical director this week is Marquise Neal. We had help from Sean Gannon, Zoe Sobel, and Bob Schaefer. Happy trails to our departing intern, Alex Schroeder. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word this week comes from the champ.
I am the greatest.
Still, I'm Bill Littlefield. I'll be back next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game, and thank you for listening.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and your NPR station. Jane and Gerald Ketcher, supporting the Children's Movement of Florida, dedicated to helping all children enter school with the social, emotional, and intellectual skills needed to succeed. More information is available at childrensmovementflorida.org. And Heather Sturt-Haga and Paul G. Haga, supporting Salzburg Global Seminar, which works to challenge current and future leaders to solve issues of global concern. Learn more at salzburgglobal.org.